This is a HeadGum Original.
When I was sent the full script for my episode of Band of Brothers back in the year 2000, the title page said, Part 5, Crossroads by Eric Jenderson, based on the book by Stephen E. Ambrose, current revisions by Tom Hanks. I was familiar with who Ambrose was, and of course, Hanks. But Eric Jenderson was a mystery to me.
Technically, I was lead writer and supervising producer, yeah. I came on in the earliest days when it was literally just me and Tom to create the Bible for the series, to figure it out. It turned out to like a 275-page Bible.
When I first reached out to Eric, my assumption was that I would never hear back, because to me, he existed on that plane of Band of Brothers production that's been so far unattainable. But he got back to me right away, and when we started talking, he was so disarming that it immediately put me at ease.
Stephen Ambrose's book had inspired a lot of the members of Easy Company to re-remember things and to dig into their journals and letters, and they sent them all to Winters. He was sort of the nexus for everybody, for the company, in his home in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And so I went to Hershey and established what would grow into an extraordinary friendship and relationship with Major Winters. I would end up delivering the eulogy at his memorial service. It was an amazing and really profound relationship. And it was over the course of about 4 to 6 months that I just immersed myself in the story of Easy Company, pouring through it, working with Winters on a daily basis.
You can probably tell that Eric is a passionate guy. Now, I've talked to a lot of actors on this podcast, but even the most articulate ones are not quite the same as talking to a writer like Eric.
I've always had this notion that the thing that really makes the sunsets off of Santa Monica so spectacular, everybody says it's smog, but it's not. I think it's fear. I think it's fear that gathers off the coast over Los Angeles or over Hollywood every day and drifts out over the coast and then explodes with the sunset. It's the strangest business that anybody could ever invent. And its fuel is sort of fear. So yeah, you can invest your heart and soul into a multitude of amazing projects. And for a multitude of reasons, they just sort of wither and disappear. It's an opportunity to test your strength of character. And the reason that it stunned you so much is because you were doing it for the right reasons. Frequently, the people who are termed creatives in this business, you know, writers, actors, directors, are almost always doing what they do for the right reasons, because they're idealists. And that's incredibly important. That's a precious thing.
I remember staring at the cover page of my Band of Brothers script and marveling that Tom Hanks was going to direct my episode. And then looking at Eric's name and wondering, who was this guy? Would he be on set? Would I get to meet him? The answer to that last one was no, by the way. Eric was in California during Band of Brothers filming and never traveled to England. But one thing I could not have anticipated was that someday, decades later, he would have a similar curiosity about me.
But see, this is why I think that one of the greatest things is the rejection for Zelensky, because without that, you wouldn't have created this podcast. And this podcast has more to do with what you're talking about now, and it's more universal than most people would think if they just looked at the description, because you're able to delve in to some real truths about this incredibly bizarre business that we're all in.
Real truths. The premise of this entire podcast is the pursuit of one real truth: why I was fired from the role of Private Zelensky. And in all my conversations about him, I've only talked about that soldier as a character or a plot device. A way to convey the discomfort of Dick Winters, played by Damian Lewis, suddenly being behind a desk while his men are putting themselves in the line of fire. On the pages of my original script, Private Zelensky was only ever referred to by his rank and last name. But on IMDb, the character is listed as John S. Zelensky Jr., which is an odd detail to just emerge from seemingly nowhere.
Oh yeah, he was a real guy. Everybody was. There's not a single invented character, you know, in the series.
That's what I assumed, yeah.
Actually, Zelensky didn't appear in the Bible, my version of episode 5 in the Bible. Mm-hmm. It was when I was writing the script and talking to Winters that Zelensky came up, and he was fondly remembering Zelensky. And that was a whole new, that was a revelation to me. So I had to put Zelensky in because his description of Zelensky was fantastic. I'll come back to that because I suspect that there could be a way to solve your entire problem here.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's possible. It's just possible.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
My name is Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. The reason I was told at the time is that he saw my audition tape and thought that I had dead eyes.
Now, I must say also, knowing Tom, I cannot for the life of me imagine him ever saying that. That's not a Hanksian thing to say. That just does not ring Tom to me.
And that's the short version.
Zelensky originally appeared in the script in a very, very simple scene. It was just a two-hander with Zelensky and Winters. And I was just looking through the...
Eric talked me through his recollection of how the Zelensky scene changed from its original version, which you heard me read all the way back in episode 2. Those revisions were specifically requested by Tom Hanks. It is amazing to hear the level of detail that went into creating such a small functional role as Zelensky.
And to give you a sense of the verisimilitude of this thing, I mean, we decided early on that we had such an embarrassment of riches in this story. You know, the story of one company that goes from training D-Day to Hitler's Eagle's Nest. I mean, holy smokes. And Tom and I decided very specifically, I remember the phone call, we have to set the bar so high on this project. Because you know in production, the bar is going to fall. It's never going to be as perfect as you want it to be. But if we made it impossibly high, if it fell, it would still be okay. So when I was doing the Bible and doing the research for this thing, I decided, what the hell? I mean, let's just go full bore. Paratroopers as a whole can't stand exaggeration. If somebody says there was 3 feet of snow at Bastogne, they'll say another one. It was like 18 inches. They can't stand that stuff. And I decided to take it to an extreme and make sure that if there was any detail, that it was accurate. All I had to do is call Winters up and say, what did Nixon like to eat? Like when, you know, back at the CP. Well, bacon sandwiches.
And a bacon sandwich. What, you want something? Bacon sandwich. You give that to Carl.
Perfect. It's going to be bacon sandwiches. It was all very, very specific. Which brings me to a thing that I used to do with Winters. I would often ask him, what's the one thing that stands out when you think of Liebgott, when you think of Moose, what's the one thing that immediately pops into your mind about them? And I asked him about Zelensky, because he said Zelensky was kind of a dopey guy. Not dopey, stupid. He was kind of a dopey-looking guy.
Right.
Goofy-looking, I guess. But he said the one thing that stood out were his eyes. His eyes were so alive and young and full of promise and innocent, and they just, it's like they sparkled.
Oh, my God.
And I said, really? And I said, so, I mean, I got to ask you, what would you think if I told you that on that fateful day, I got a call from Tom in London saying, what was it that you told me about Zelensky? And I said, well, it's his eyes. Oh, right. I remember that. Okay, thanks.
Wow. Wow. Okay. This is interesting.
Kind of puts a whole new spin on it, doesn't it?
This is such a relief to me to know that this was part of the conversation.
Well, but the problem is it wasn't. I just wanted to suggest that as a possibility. It never happened. But... I thought it would be kind of interesting to just sort of explore the possibility that the one thing about Zelensky were his eyes.
Eric, I can't believe you punked me on my own podcast. This is devastating to me, Eric.
I'm sorry, buddy. I'm sorry, pal.
All right, so if you're still reeling from that, I get it. And I'm sorry. But honestly, I felt like it was important for you, the listener, to experience it the same way I did. And if you're feeling anywhere close to how I felt, you're probably now asking, okay, wait, so what is the real truth here? Which is totally valid. It took many, many minutes of backtracking, and I don't know if it was just me being naive or if Eric was just really good at apologizing, but we set the record straight. The only things he made up were Zelinsky's bright eyes and the phone call from Hanks. Everything else, the extensive research with Winters, Nixon's bacon sandwiches, even Zelinsky being a real goofy guy, all of that was true. Eric's goal wasn't to cause chaos. It was to illustrate something.
If that were true, it would sort of puncture the whole podcast. It would sort of be the end of it all. And I don't want the podcast to end. I think you have too much left to explore. But it would be a delightful thing if it were true.
This is, honestly, if any other guest than you had done that to me, I'd be furious.
I believed the lie because I wanted to. But nothing in my search so far has indicated that the answer is going to be something as simple as Tom Hanks calling to clarify the physical traits of a character with two lines.
Oh, because I really thought this. You were handing me the Rosetta Stone. I thought you were giving me the key to this.
I know. I couldn't resist, though. But I do remember specifically that Tom did love the character of Zelinsky.
You know, by now, this is all an effort to understand why Tom Hanks felt I wasn't right to play Zelinsky. And part of answering that question is considering whether there's always been some fundamental aspect of the character that I wasn't quite right for. The way he talked, moved. I mean, if Eric actually knew that his eyes were brighter than mine, I'd take it. And Eric's knowledge of the major players in Band of Brothers is expansive, but a character like Zelinsky, who went mainly unnoticed on the show, wasn't someone that he had a ton of info on. His research was limited to how Winters described him, not who he really was as a person.
But it would be easy enough to find out. I could do some work on that if you like.
That would be so great, because I would love to know.
I think we should find out.
I would love to. Anything that you could find out would be amazing to me.
A few weeks later, Eric called me back.
Hi, Connor.
Hi, Eric.
I dug into my notes and didn't find an awful lot, but some further research proved very fruitful. I contacted a friend of mine who's a historian of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne, of which Easy Company was a company, 2nd Battalion. And he was able to find some data. He served in the 2nd Battalion Headquarters Company in a light machine gun platoon. He made the Normandy and the Holland jumps. He was awarded his combat infantry.
There weren't too many details, just a list of facts derived from service records and an obituary. Date of birth, his army serial number, rank, a list of awards, and his date of death in 1992. According to Eric, he spent his post-war life around Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he started a family, had children and grandchildren. He gave me a better picture of who Zelinsky was on paper, but not a whole lot as to who he was as a person. I think I'd hoped Eric would come back with more. Specific anecdotes from Major Winters about his goofy orderly, physical description, anything more personal than public records. But the truth was that Band of Brothers didn't need extensive research on Zelinsky. His existence and a vague recollection of who he was really all that was needed.
But there's also a lot of clues here in the internet age, of all the names of his children, and it would be certainly possible, I'm sure, to pretty quickly run down somebody, probably still in Pittsburgh, somewhere in Pennsylvania, who was directly related to him.
Okay, some legwork. That's not too much to ask of a podcast. I mean, we've spent over a year at this point chasing high-profile actors, casting directors, agents, Tom Hanks. Tracking down civilians to talk about their parents or grandparents shouldn't be hard, should it, in the internet age? But after a couple of months of trying, it became apparent, slowly apparent, that it would be that hard. Luckily, I do have producers to help me with this kind of thing. And one of them, Mike Comite, jumped into this pursuit sort of obsessively. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Now, I know how everything in this pans out in the end, but I'm a little fuzzy on everything that happened on the way there. So I guess let's just start with what happened when you started looking at everything that Eric gave us.
Well, like Eric suggested, the obituary was enough for us to track down the descendants of John Zelinsky, pretty much right where he said they'd be. Our co-producer, Harry Nelson, who you know, he dug up phone numbers, and some of them were disconnected, some of them just didn't lead anywhere at all. We tried Facebook messages. They all went unread or ignored for a very long time. And the final thing we were going to try was calling the grandson of Zelensky at his job. And just as we were like, all right, tomorrow we're doing this. I actually got a Facebook message from him. He actually responded.
Right. And this is the point where things started to shift a little, right?
Yeah. I had asked in my original message to him if he was the grandson of a World War II veteran named John Zelensky. He confirmed in his response that he was. And I gave him some of the details that Eric provided. And the next day he got back to me and he was just kind of like, this is very nice, but like, I think you probably have the wrong Zelensky, because my grandfather was actually stationed in Burma building and maintaining airstrips during World War II.
That's Burma, India.
That's the Pacific part of World War II, very far removed from what took place in Band of Brothers.
The grandson of the Burma Zelensky confirmed that most of the details Eric had provided us were accurate. Date of birth, date of death, even his service number, a unique identifier given to each soldier when they enlist. That matched too. Everything lined up except for any record of this Zelensky serving in Europe at any point during the war. He even sent photos, a headshot of John Zelensky and one of a warplane with the words Burma Buzzards written on the side of it. So while you were finding all this out and relaying it to me, I was relaying it back to Eric.
Yes. And then you sent me one of the most anxiety-inducing texts that I've ever received.
Yeah, I have the text here. This is on Thursday, November 19th, 2020. Eric wants you to give him a call, period.
You put a period, it's going to change the tone of your text. Like, seriously?
You texted back to me in all caps, why am I in trouble? And I said, no, you are the historian now. That's a Captain Phillips joke.
I definitely did not understand that joke.
And then I clarified that he all he had said was, ask Mike to call me, please. So then you called him.
I did, fearfully.
And what did he say?
He was sort of shocked.
So he was in the Pacific Theater, but he didn't say that the serial number matched, did he?
He did. He said serial number is correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so hold on a second.
But then it sort of turned into trying to conform the new information that I'd presented him into the narrative that we've already been weaving.
That means that Zelensky went on after the war to serve in the Pacific, which is bizarre. I mean, this guy's turning into G.I. Joe. How hardcore is this guy? No, we got to get to the bottom of this.
Is it likely that someone would have finished fighting in Europe and then continued to go on and keep fighting the war in the Pacific?
I mean, I'm no historian. There might have been someone who did that. I just can't imagine that somebody would finish.
They would want to go home. Yeah. They'd want to go home when they're, yeah.
But even beyond that, there's the picture.
Okay, yes, the photograph. This was very exciting when we got this.
Yeah, so with all the information that Eric sent us came this photo. It's a really, really famous picture of a bunch of the real-life Band of Brothers at the Berghof, which was Hitler's home in Germany that the Allies took in 1945.
It's often said that that's a picture of Easy Company in Berchtesgaden. It's not. It's a picture of 2nd Battalion Headquarters Company. There happened to be some old members of Easy Company in it.
The reason Eric sent us this photo is not just because it's a very cool photo, but because it is relevant to our podcast.
Right, yeah. He identified the 12 men in the photo, and those identifications actually were given to him by Major Dick Winters himself during that research period that he talked about earlier. Like, it's actually handwritten onto a copy of that photo that he gave to Eric.
That is, in fact, Zelensky, for sure and certain, in that picture, that guy that we identified.
Yeah, he looks like he's on the smaller side, dark hair. His uniform is like a little too big for him. He actually kind of reminds me of Adam Sims in Band of Brothers.
That's the actor who got the part of Zelensky after I was fired.
Yeah, I didn't want to bring that part up.
That's fine. So in your opinion, does the guy in the photograph standing on the left, does he look like the Burma Zelensky?
I don't think so. I mean, it doesn't really look like him. They have different shaped faces and different haircuts, as well as you can tell. Because like the Burma Zelensky is like a portrait, a full on like smiling portrait, very close up, like headshot type thing. And the photo of Zelensky at the Berghof is really just like, it's a far away picture.
Yeah.
But even like beyond the physical appearance of these guys, like the grandson of the Burma Zelensky, he has records of all of his grandfather's commendations, including the Asiatic Pacific Theater Ribbon, the World War II Victory Medal, but there's no mention of any European events or anything like that in there.
Yeah, it strikes me as that would be a deeply unusual secret to keep from your family.
Yeah, it's like taking Hitler's home for the Allied forces seems like something you'd want people to know about, or like it's high bragging rights, you know?
Yeah, you would lead with that. You wouldn't lead with, I built airstrips in Burma.
Right, exactly.
Right. So where does that leave us at this point? Are we back to square one?
I spent a lot of time on the phone with Eric going over the possibilities. And at one point, he actually revealed something that kind of complicated things.
In 506 2nd Battalion Headquarters Company, there's also, his name is Zygmunt Zaleski.
A Zelensky and a Zaleski in the same unit. If we were going to explore every possibility for who Zelensky in Band of Brothers was supposed to represent, we had to ask if it was possible that maybe Dick Winters had gotten his men confused.
Winters was such an exquisite stickler to detail, you know, and the idea that he could have confused Zelensky with Zaleski is really unlikely.
Not only had Winters written the name Zelensky on Eric's photo of the Americans at the Berghof, they'd had more than one conversation about his orderly. If there was a mistake made when writing Band of Brothers, it wasn't corrected before Winters' passing in 2011. So in the midst of searching for the real Zelensky, we started a search for the real Zaleski, just to be sure that this wasn't some kind of a mix-up. Mike confirmed Eric's info by reaching out to the 101st Airborne Division Association, which confirmed that Sigmund F. Zaleski had served in Dick Winters' unit, and also provided his service number, which we used to locate Zaleski's military registration card.
And then from that, you get a whole bunch of information, his home address, his birthday, his height, his weight, basically like everything that was able to help us trace him to South Bend, Indiana. And for us, what made us say, okay, this is our guy, was one specific article from a South Bend newspaper, the South Bend Tribune, on April 23rd, 1953, and it specifically mentions a Sigmund F. Zaleski, who was a World War II veteran wounded in the Battle of the Bulge, and it has his commendations listed there.
Battle of the Bulge, a big World War II battle that involved the Band of Brothers.
That's right, yeah. So that kind of pins him.
So this was a commemorative article on Zaleski about his service.
I wish it was. It was an article on his sentencing when he pled guilty to second-degree burglary.
The judge in the article, the one who sentenced Zaleski, was quoted saying, "You have a pugnacious attitude, and your splendid war record may be due to that. But in civilian life, you must control yourself." Based on the other news articles we found on this specific Sigmund F. Zaleski, he had a hard time doing so. He was arrested a few times for a string of burglaries, one at a disabled American veterans hall, and on three separate occasions crashed tractor trailers he was driving for work, in one instance destroying a family home and injuring its residents. Zaleski clearly had hardships coming back from war, that much is clear. But could he have been Winter's orderly? With the so-called Zelensky identified in the famous Berghof photo, one way to tell would be through photographic evidence. Did you find a picture of him?
There were a couple in the papers, but they were kind of like the quality you'd expect to find in a newspaper scan from the 1950s.
Could you tell from any of them, did he look like the person that Eric identified as Zelensky in the photo?
A little bit. The hair and the face sort of look similar, but there's not enough detail in the photos to really say. The biggest tell is Zaleski's registration card, which lists him as 5'11" when he enlisted. But the second man from the left, who is said to be Zelensky, he looks a lot shorter than 5'11".
So we think that's not Zaleski in the photo.
It's not looking like it, no.
So is it Zelensky in the photo?
And this is actually where things started getting strange for me.
So nothing up to this point counts as strange?
Some of it, I guess, but this is where it got stranger.
Okay, I actually think I know this next part because at this point, I started getting a flurry of text messages from you, starting with an image of an eagle, a golden eagle, and two big red dice connected by like an arch. You sent me this picture and said, "Does that symbol mean anything to you?" And I texted back, "No, what is it?" And you replied, "I'm down the rabbit hole." So what was happening at that point?
I promise you I'll get to it. But first, we have to take a break. I've never had to do this before.
to throw it a break?
Yeah, it's weird because we're still on the Zoom call. And
well, you just sit here and don't say anything and I will do the ads. Is that okay?
That would make me feel more comfortable, I think.
Should we look into each other's eyes while I do these ads? Is that weird?
That would make me more uncomfortable, actually.
Dead Eyes will be right back after these messages. There's a scene in the 1998 movie You've Got Mail where Tom Hanks tells Meg Ryan to go to the mattresses. He's quoting a phrase from The Godfather, go to the mattresses. He's giving her some advice via email because that movie is all about two people emailing each other. But even out of context, I think that phrase holds up well as advice, especially if the mattresses you go to are the ones made by Helix Sleep, which are designed specifically to meet your needs. Helix has a quiz you can take online. It's really quick, takes about 2 minutes, and they can tell you exactly which mattress is right for your body type and sleep preferences. Everybody is different, and Helix knows that, so they have several different kinds of mattresses to choose from. They have soft, medium, and firm mattresses, mattresses to cool you down if you sleep hot, and even a Helix Plus mattress for plus-size folks. I took the Helix quiz, and I was matched with the Midnight Lux mattress because I wanted something that would accommodate tossing and turning and was neither too soft nor too firm. Feels great. If you look at that scene of Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan emailing back and forth to each other, pretend they are instead using those laptops to take the Helix quiz. Bingo. You've got mattress. So if you're looking for a mattress, it's really simple. You take the quiz, you order the mattress that you're matched to, and the mattress comes right to your door, shipped for free. You don't ever need to go to a mattress store again. And you don't have to take my word for it. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ and Wired magazine. Just go to helixsleep.com/deadeyes, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights, risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it. But you will. Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. That's up to $200 off all mattress orders plus 2 free pillows at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. What interferes with your happiness? Is something preventing you from achieving your goals? We talk a lot about disappointment on this podcast, how hard it is for all of us when we don't get what we want, when things aren't going our way. In my own experience, I can't help but think that there were times when it might have been healthier if I had talked to somebody who was qualified to help me deal with my disappointment back when I was really feeling it. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp, which can connect you with a licensed professional therapist based on your specific personal needs. It's safe, it's convenient, it's online. You can start communicating in less than 24 hours. And it's not self-help, it's professional counseling. BetterHelp will make sure you find the therapist who is right for you. And they make it easy and free to change counselors if you need to, until you find the one you're happy with. It's more affordable than traditional offline in-person counseling, and financial aid is available. You can send a message to your counselor anytime, and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without ever having to go to a physical office and sit in a waiting room. And because BetterHelp isn't limited by geography, there is a broad range of expertise available, a lot more than you might have access to wherever you're currently living. Licensed professional counselors who are specialized in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem. Anything you share is confidential, of course. You can check out the testimonials posted daily on their site. Start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/deadeyes. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/deadeyes. Okay, so I'm still here with Mike Comite, one producer of this podcast. Just to recap, Eric's Burma Zelensky, not the Band of Brothers Zelensky. Sigmund F. Zaleski was sort of rough around the edges post-war, possibly mistaken for Zelensky, but not likely because he doesn't appear to be the person ID'd by Major Winters.
That is what we have so far, yeah.
And then you sent me all those text messages while presumably something was developing.
I'm really sorry about sending all those.
So when Mike reached out to the 101st Airborne Division Association about Zaleski, he also got confirmation that a John S. Zelinsky was part of the same unit depicted in Band of Brothers. And he received an obituary from 1980, which listed no living relatives. Mike did find an archived website for the 506th Infantry, which hadn't been updated in almost a decade.
So John Zelinsky appears on a bunch of other pages from this site, listing deceased members of the 506th, and on a page listing the email addresses of members of the 506th.
John Zelinsky had an email address even though he died in 1980.
So this website has email addresses for veterans, but also for next of kin.
So a family member was listed for Zelinsky.
Yeah, a person by the name of Mark Sauer, who is listed as the nephew of John Zelinsky.
And you emailed him?
Immediately. But it looked like a company email address, knowing how people come and go from jobs and like sometimes lose access to work emails. My hopes were not high. I email the person and I ask him if he's the nephew of a veteran named John Zelinsky. And I figure it'll probably be like a few days before I hear anything back. So then...
Okay, so wait, this is where your texts to me pick back up. You texted me, "I'm now cold messaging every reasonably aged person on Facebook with the same name as the nephew."
I did spend an hour cold messaging all those Mark Sauers on Facebook.
And were any of them the right guy?
Like even up until today, like only two or three have responded and they had no idea what I was talking about. So just 30 or 40 people just being bombarded. Mm-hmm. I went back to my email after doing all that and saw that Mark Sauer had written me back.
Yeah. Well, what did he say?
It was really just a short, simple reply. He said, "Sergeant John Zelinsky was my Uncle Johnny. Yes. Died March 14th, 1980 in Chicago, Illinois."
And what did you say back?
So I send him the photo Eric sent us.
The 12 soldiers at the Berghof with Zelinsky.
Right. And this is where I messed up. I specifically asked him if he could identify his uncle as the second man from the left standing.
Okay. So this is like if it was a police lineup, you know, you pointing and saying, "That's the guy," before you bring in the person. Like,
"Can you please point to the criminal second from the left?" Yes.
Right. So this is not really like if we're trying to get an unbiased response, you've now told him which person that you're looking to identify.
Yeah, I'm not good at this.
So if it turns out that this guy is not who he says he is, he is now just immediately knows which person to ID. So does he identify Zelinsky?
He does not. His email reply says, "Crouching in profile on the extreme left with a cigarette in his hand, hair slicked back, just as I remember him."
Okay, and that is not the person who Winters labeled as Zelinsky in Eric's photo.
It's not. He completely disregarded my leading question, extremely leading question,
right.
And he just points to this other guy.
So this is strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's this crouching guy in the photo. So then what?
Besides you, the only real person I have to talk about this with is Eric. So I call him and his immediate thought is...
I think this guy's fucking with you.
Which I have to admit that I was also starting to think.
Yeah, you texted me that as well, where you were like, "I think this guy might be fucking with me."
Yeah, I have to be skeptical on this stuff a lot, even though I want to believe. Like, Eric starts to point out all the reasons why the crouching guy cannot possibly be Zelinsky. And the biggest and most definitive reason is that crouching guy has already been positively ID'd as this guy, John Van Kuyuk, who was not an American soldier.
John Van Kuyuk was a member of the Dutch Resistance, a movement in Holland opposed to the Nazi regime during World War II. He fought alongside the Band of Brothers and is actually a character with lines in episode 4 of the miniseries.
"Mr. Van Kuyuk here is with the Dutch Resistance.
We've been waiting and hoping for this day. Anything we can do to help you, we will do. Anything. Be happy to have your help."
In Eric's copy of the Berghof photo, Dick Winters ID'd Van Kuyuk as the crouching guy. And on top of that, Eric also mentioned that Van Kuyuk's daughter herself had done the same. The very few other wartime photos we can dig up of him do bear a resemblance to the crouching guy. But there is one detail that suggests it's Van Kuyuk.
The number one thing is look at his pants. They're not bloused. He doesn't have his trousers bloused into his jump boots. He's not even wearing jump boots.
Okay, this is something I was not at all familiar with, blousing trousers. Can you explain what this is or what it means?
I similarly am unfamiliar with this concept, but Eric explained it to me. The basics of it is that paratroopers would tuck their jump trousers into their really tall jump boots.
The paratroopers were the only unit in World War II who were allowed to blouse their trousers. It was against regulations for anybody else to do it. Of course, the reason they did it is because they were jumping out of planes, right? So your trousers, the wind didn't go up your pants. It was taken so seriously, there were multiple incidents of enlisted men getting into fights with officers of other units. Some, like, corporal punched out a captain of another unit while on leave in Paris because all the other units wanted to blouse their trousers too. And whenever a paratrooper found somebody from a unit that wasn't a paratroop unit with their trousers bloused, they'd kick the shit out. I mean, it was serious.
Okay, so Crouching Guy is not Zelensky.
This is another instance where it is unclear. And that's because there are other ID'd Americans in the photo who do not have blouse trousers. Like, notably, Captain Lloyd J. Cox. He's second from the right in the photo.
So the trousers are not... The trousers, we can't count on them as a definitive yes or no. There are exceptions.
It looks like there's just 12 guys all in different states of relaxation. There are bottles of wine on the table. They're smoking. I don't think it's a sure sign. So Eric tells me some questions to ask. Then I go and push back a little bit on the nephew, in a nice way, about like the trousers and John Van Kuyuk being previously ID'd as the guy crouching. And the response I get back from him is like a little bit more firm. Like, he, I think he senses I'm pushing back a little bit. He goes, I knew him personally and can absolutely confirm my uncle John Zelensky is the crouching man. He provides a couple more details about his uncle, but what really grabs my attention was the photo he attached, which is just a photo of a gun.
And to be clear, this was not, he was not threatening you. This was not like him sending you an intimidating message.
No, it's not that. It's a photo of a gun in a display briefcase with like nice red velvet inside and a little card insert that says in loving memory of John S. Zelensky, plus like a bunch of other text that I can't really read because of the resolution of the picture. And I'm still in a little bit of disbelief at that point. So I spend the evening with the picture. I run it through some photo forensic software, reverse image search, and it comes up clean. It is most definitely a unique photograph.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that the gun is real, though. I mean, anyone could print out that card and take a picture of it.
Right. That's a possibility that I process. And I go to bed with that thought, thinking I'm going to wake up the next morning and get back to work on talking to the nephew. But when I get up the next morning, I already have a bunch of emails from him with a bunch of documents, including John S. Zelensky's honorable discharge papers. His commendations are listed in it that confirm a Purple Heart and a European Theater Ribbon and a customs declaration form for one pistol. That customs declaration form is authorized and signed for by a commanding officer and is dated November 1945.
Okay, so that all seems real.
Yeah. Like
that would be a lot of effort to go to prank a podcast that they had never heard of a few minutes earlier.
Along with those forms, Mark sent me a dozen or so pictures of John Zelensky himself. And it's the first time me or you or any of us is looking into the eyes of this person, John Zelensky.
And what does he look like?
He's got a stocky build and kind of a large head, hair slicked back in like every photo that was sent to me, which matches the crouching man in the Berghoff photos. And in every picture, he's looking straight at the camera with the same smirk or grin. And I'm going to say this right now, and I promise you that I'm not just saying this, you know, just because it's a funny podcast or whatever, it is something that I truly do believe. In the younger photos of Zelensky, he sort of resembles you, just a little bit. Like, and that's where you come back in. That's everything.
Wow. Thank you, Mike, for all of this.
Truly my pleasure, also my burden as your producer.
At this point, it felt like we had to have found the right guy. This Zelensky was directly linked to the Band of Brothers unit, and his family had the paperwork to back it up. The one thing still missing was the connection to Major Winters.
It's very surprising to find somebody showing an interest in John. I mean, you know, he's just one other guy of many that served over there and did a lot of things. But interesting.
Mike Kukulski is one of the nephews of John S. Zelinsky. He and his brother Ed spent time around him in their childhood growing up around Chicago.
It's recording. Okay. Alrighty, good.
Hi, Ed. So basically, we talked to your cousin Mark.
Our first point of contact, Mark Sauer, was another Zelinsky nephew and the first person to positively identify him in the Berghoff photo.
Absolutely. Unequivocally, that's the gentleman on the extreme left crouching in profile with a cigarette in his hand. That's John Stanley Zelinsky, my uncle.
The crouching guy, previously identified as the Dutch national Van Kuyk.
And you knew him personally. You had a relationship with him.
Yes, I did. He lived in Chicago, Illinois. We visited usually every Christmas. So growing up in the 60s as a young teen, I did know him very well. This photograph on at Berchtesgaden, he's 20 years old. I knew him 20 years after that, and he looked the same, except for a little bit of gray.
Yeah, the physique and profile of the guy standing doesn't match John at all the way I remember him.
He's the crouching guy. And yeah. I have no doubt in my mind that's him crouching. And the hair is similar to things I would have seen him do, his hair like that, slick back like that.
Like with Brill Cream or something. And that's how I remember him. He always had this little crooked, shit-eating grin on his face, and he had a cigarette in his right hand.
Lucky Strikes was what they issued in the sea rations back in the day. And he was a Lucky Strikes guy till he started having heart trouble from smoking.
He always seemed happy and smiling and all that. And he also seemed like he cared about people.
What do you remember about his sense of humor?
I can't remember things specifically. Other than that, he seemed to always be laughing or be in a jovial mood.
He was sort of like a comedian. I mean, I can't remember specific jokes or anything, but he was always lighthearted and very extroverted.
Do you remember what your uncle's eyes were like?
He was blue-eyed and always kind of animated.
I wouldn't say they were dead eyes. I would say bright eyes, actually. So there you go. Tom Hanks had it on you.
This was a repetitive joke. Whenever you asked him, how many combat jumps did you make? He said, I jumped one time, and that was in training. All the other times, I got thrown out by the jump sergeant. The reason he became a paratrooper was, as he was sitting there with the recruiter, somebody walked by in a very fancy uniform, different from all the others. A fancy colored kerchief, different colored piping.
He liked the way they looked. He liked their uniform. Yeah.
The recruiter said, that's a paratrooper. And John had no idea what that was, but he said, I want to be one of those. That uniform looks awesome.
What did he do for a living when he came back from the war?
Kind of weird, a little morbid, I guess.
He grew up in a funeral home, and they owned a funeral home in Chicago, Zelinsky Funeral Home. He stayed in that field, let's say, because he was delivering caskets.
He would drive an 18-wheeler and deliver coffins to funeral homes all over the United States. He was a traveling truck driver, and that was the only thing he dealt with was caskets. And he did that for like 30 years till he retired. That was his only job after he got out. Kind of odd.
Did he and Bernice have any children?
No, they never did. I don't know what the reason behind. I mean, I think they wanted them. Maybe physically it wasn't possible or something, or mm-hmm. It just didn't work out. That wasn't that uncommon back in those days, that there were issues that they couldn't deal with. But no, they never had any children.
They always hosted a lot of parties at their house with a lot of their friends as well. They were outgoing, went places, did things, and had parties.
He could drink. I think all those guys used to drink. I used to see that in our family. All these guys were all veterans. They didn't talk about PTSD in those days. They all used alcohol as a way to deal with all that, and it was the way they all did it together. He was a happy kind of drinker, though, so he wasn't like a belligerent guy when he had too much. All my uncles, I had uncles in Iwo Jima and on boats and Army Air Corps and all that, and none of them talked about what they really experienced. I think they didn't want kids to hear it. They didn't want the wives and the women to hear it.
I didn't know him super well, and I really, really, really regret not asking a lot more searching questions about his wartime experience when I had the opportunity, but I was a kid and I didn't know any better. It's a shame.
You had to coax them to start talking about it. Unfortunately, I think by the time we figured all that out, John had passed away.
John Zelinsky died in 1980, over a decade before Stephen E. Ambrose's Band of Brothers was published. and 20 years before the HBO series depicted him and his fellow soldiers on television.
If he had lasted another year or two when I got out of the academy, I think he'd have been very interested in talking to me about something that I would now understand and relate to.
I do recall at his funeral, there was a great outpouring of other service members.
The nephews had varying degrees of familiarity with the miniseries.
Do they mention him by name as Zelinsky?
They specifically say Private Zelinsky.
Wow. I have to go look at that episode because I don't recall that.
I've heard, there's the one scene where they call out John's name, Private Zelinsky or something of that nature. They call for him and this guy shows up, and then they're in some sort of room, and I don't know what they're planning or talking about.
So far, nothing you've said is incorrect. That's the scene.
The nephews did get one war story about their Uncle Johnny. He told the origin of the German pistol that Mark had shown us earlier. The weapon, along with the story of how it fell into Private Zelinsky's hands, had been passed down by his widow, Bernice. As related by Mark, the engraved firearm was liberated towards the end of the war when the Allied forces took Hitler's compounds in Berchtesgaden, Germany.
He was with a group of six or seven men from the 101st HQ Company, and Colonel Winters and Captain Nixon were with them, and they were in charge, and there was like half a dozen of them, and they were sweeping through the halls and the rooms and everything, just finding out what was there, kind of getting the lay of the land after they'd taken it. And they came to one little room off of a hall, and in this room was a dead German general who had committed suicide. He'd laid on the bunk and shot himself in the head 2 days before, as the place was about to fall. Johnny noticed that he killed himself with a Luger, and that is like the sine qua non of war booty. Everybody wanted a Luger, and he'd never gotten one. So he wasn't going to speak up then, because obviously the officers had right of priority on that. But he just made a note of it. And then they continued the sweep and everything. And as they left, that part of the building, after a little time, he excused himself from the group, raced back to the room, and the Luger was gone. Somebody else had gotten there just before him, and he was bitterly disappointed. And then just on the off chance, he started looking around the room, and he looked under the bunk. And back against the wall, pushed against the wall, underneath the bunk, was a wooden presentation case, inside of which was a beautifully engraved Belgian high-power 9mm pistol, exquisitely engraved. It was obviously a presentation piece. And when he was coming back on the troop ship after demobilization, he was showing off his pistol to some other troops on the ship, and a captain, unaffiliated with the 101st, saw the booty and basically said, well, I think I should confiscate that until we get to the bottom of this. And he knew that if he gave it to the officer, he'd never see it again. So basically, he took the pistol in the box and he held it over the railing of the ship and he said, I will drop it into the Atlantic Ocean before I'm going to let you steal it from me. And the officer got frustrated and walked away. So I came that close to not getting this souvenir from my uncle.
The one thing we'd been searching for was the John Zelinsky that Dick Winters had reminisced about to Eric when the two were researching for the HBO series at his chicken farm in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Because that's the guy who Eric put in his script.
And the thing we're trying to confirm is whether or not your uncle would have ever been Winter's orderly, whether he ever would have been in that kind of position.
I'd have no idea at all. I know his records showed him as a light machine gunner, but that just might have been the last position he held. I don't really know.
I know that he kind of worshipped Dick Winters, and he just thought very, very highly of him. But whether he was actually his orderly, I actually don't know. He never said anything like that. He never really talked about it except to say what a fine officer he was and what a great guy he was to work with.
We were pretty young, probably 11, 12, 13 years old, somewhere in there. I can't remember the exact date. That was on the way to the reunion in Philadelphia.
And on the way over there, he kept talking about we're going to go to a chicken farm. That's all he said. No, he didn't call it anything else. Just it was his chicken farm. A friend of his, he had this chicken farm.
For us as city kids going to the farm, that's pretty much what our experience was. We were looking at the chicken pens. We went swimming in the pond and horseback riding and things like that.
We got a tour of the chicken coop. And the one memory I had was this, how god-awful the smell was.
The wives went off and did wife stuff. And the kids went out and did kid stuff. And then John and Winters went back and probably reminisced about whatever they were talking about.
The one most vivid memory I have, though, was the being in his screen room of his house that afternoon, and there was a rain that came through. And I just remember my aunt and Uncle John, Dick Winters and his wife, were all sitting in there, and it was just mundane chatter. If they did talk about the war or any of that stuff, it was not in front of my brother and I. John definitely knew Dick, and Dick knew John, How deep that relationship was, I don't know. It obviously was pretty good if you let him into his house there and let us, have fun on the farm.
So at that point, as far as you knew, this was just his old friend who owned a chicken farm.
Right. That's all we knew. Just one acquaintance.
When I talked to them afterwards, I said, well, who is this guy? Why did we stop off here? And he says it was somebody that he had served in the war with, and that he was a big hero. And I think he was trying to keep it simple for kids. He says he's a big hero who killed a lot of Germans. For us at that age, that was all we needed to know. We were impressed by that, and we kind of knew not to ask any more questions, I guess, about that kind of thing.
Do you recall at what point you later on realized that Dick Winters was the chicken farm guy?
Yeah, when Band of Brothers came out.
Toward the end of the series, they were showing all the original people and interviewing them. And when Dick Winters came on, I immediately recognized him. I said, I know who that is. He's the guy that we saw in Pennsylvania. I read Band of Brothers as well. And he talks about on D-Day when they did the attack on the gun emplacement. I think there were about 13 guys taken over, about 50 Germans is who they were opposed against. And he was surprised that I think it went as well as it did. And they had as few people wounded, as few casualties as they did. He said, if I get through this, I'm going to go back to Pennsylvania and get a little farm in Pennsylvania. And that's what I'm going to do. So he says that in the book in Band of Brothers. And I remember noting that, hey, I recognize that guy. And that's exactly what he did. He went to Hershey, Pennsylvania, and he eventually got on a farm. And that's what he ended up doing.
One thing that was passed down among their uncle's affects was a faded computer printout of the Berghoff photo. At the top of it, someone had written, boy, those were the good old days.
And as far as I know, is his handwriting, as far as I know. And then on the back, he wrote down the names of 11 of the 12. He didn't list himself. And I think Colonel Winter's name got clipped off the top. But there's like 10 other names there, which I think they're in rank order. They're not in order of the photograph. So I can't hitch him up, apparently. But he listed the everybody that was in that photograph except himself.
So, what can we say about the crouching guy in the photo? The nephews all say it's their uncle. But they confirmed to us that he never pointed at it and said, hey, this is me. There are 12 soldiers in the picture and 11 names written on the back, which could mean the crouching guy is John and he didn't write down his own name. Or it could be Van Kooyek, whose name John could have left off because he didn't know the Dutch national by name or rank. That would also explain why the crouching guy was ID'd as Van Kooyek by both his own daughter and Dick Winters. Another wrinkle. In the 2006 book Beyond Band of Brothers, The War Memoirs of Major Dick Winters, you can see a copy of this photo with the crouching guy labeled as Zelinsky. Van Kooyek is not mentioned at all here. Oh, and also, there's a typo in the caption where they misspell his name with an L instead of a Z. Lelinsky. So, it's another piece of evidence that leaves us with as much doubt as it does clarity. And as much as we'd love to definitively solve the mystery of the crouching guy, that wasn't the main thing we were looking for in all of this. Our goal was to find the John Zelinsky who was depicted in Band of Brothers. And we did. It was the goofy, bright-eyed private first class who held his commanding officer in such high regard that he took his nephews to visit a chicken farm in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where the two veterans and their family sat on a screened-in porch while a storm passed, shooting the breeze about things that had nothing to do with the war in which they'd fought.
That's pretty definitive, guys.
Yeah, and they all said the same thing, which was, after everything, I took what I'd learned back to Eric to tell the truth, the real truth, of the character he put into his script 20 years ago. It was the nephew's recollection of the chicken farm that convinced Eric we'd found the right person.
That's really charming.
Yeah.
Oh, that creates such a picture for me because I spent so many hours at that chicken farm with Winters. And I can just imagine, I can just see Zelinsky coming with these kids rambling around with the swans in the pond and the big chicken barn. It's a fantastic image.
It's also beautiful to think about the mundane conversation, how hard-earned that is.
What an expression of peacetime it is to sit and talk about nothing. They weren't rehashing glory days. They weren't going through talking about trauma. They weren't talking about loss, because this is what they earned, to be able to come home safely and to care for their families and to sit around and talk about nothing.
And it's also funny to me that, much like the original casting experience of Zelensky, the hunt for the actual Zelensky has mirrored that, in that there's sometimes you get the wrong guy at first, and then you gotta do a correction, you know?
The wrong guy.
There is a good chance that if I hadn't been fired from Band of Brothers, if I had filmed that scene he wrote, I probably never would have had a conversation with Eric about anything. We likely never would have crossed paths. And then we wouldn't have learned any of this.
So it's all about, you know, I think, what are the stories we choose to tell? What are the stories that are most illustrative of a larger picture, of a larger experience? Because, you know, the stories will never end. There's an infinite number of them. The fact is, the last story about men and women at war, about soldiering, the last story of war will never, ever be told. And, you know, luckily we all got onto the story of these particular men, of which Zelensky was one.
Yeah. For a second there, I took two different meanings to that idea of the story of the last war will never be told. And there's the one version of it, which is because there will always be a next battle. And the other one was, I thought you were just saying, like, no, the last war will kill everybody and there'll be no one left to tell the story.
That's not at all what I meant.
Right. Right. No, that was what I thought at first. I thought,
you totally misinterpreted what I was saying.
It's grim.
You went to such a dark place.
It's my job. I got to go to the dark places.
Seriously. Well, you know, comedian.
Yeah.
What do you want?
When Eric pranked me, I bought it completely. Likewise, when we got info about the Burma Zelensky, my first reaction was, this is the guy. We got him. Even when that started to seem less and less logical, there was still the instinct to want to make it make sense, to believe the answers that seemed definitive. The more we dug into this, the answer that seemed the truest wasn't the first thing we found, or the craziest, that he might not have been a Zelensky at all. It was the simplest, that the John S. Zelensky, who was a member of the 101st Airborne, brought home the German gun, delivered coffins, and took his nephews to visit the chicken farm, was the one we were searching for. That's the guy that Dick Winters remembered fondly, and prompted Eric to write him into the script, where he would ultimately be sent to go get coffee and a bacon sandwich.
Although I gotta say, I'm seeing a connection between funeral home business, delivering coffins, and dead eyes. I think that there's...
Well, here's the thing. Well, this is interesting. Now, what would you think? What would you think if I told you that one of the things, because I was trying to get them to remember what he looked like, you know, what their memory of what he looked like was, and they actually said that he had kind of a cold, hard stare. He was someone who had this sort of faraway look in his eye, and often they said it was sort of like a dead-eyed gaze. What do you think of that?
It's a mic drop. I mean, come on.
Yeah. And Eric, the problem with what I just told you, though, is that it wasn't true. They said that he had bright eyes. I wanted to suggest.
See what you just did?
As a possibility, you know, it's not true, but I thought it would be kind of interesting just to see your reaction.
Okay. All right. We're even.
We're even.
But now, but somebody's got to win this. So, you know.
You'll see in the pictures. He's a pretty bright-eyed looking guy.
He's a bright-eyed fellow. Oh, look at him.
Yeah. He's a bright-eyed fellow.
He is a bright-eyed fellow. Yeah. And he ties a mean Windsor knot, too. Oh, here we go. Wow. John S. Zelensky, ladies and gentlemen. The bright-eyed man. Just as I told you. Look at him. This is wonderful.
I started this podcast hoping that I would eventually get to talk to Tom Hanks, and that maybe he could help me fill in the blanks in a little part of my own life story. There were people from the beginning who told me that this was not possible, but I didn't want to believe them. I still don't.
and I'm certainly going to keep trying to make it happen. But I'm more aware than ever that we are all inclined to believe what we want to believe. For the time being, at the very least, there is some satisfaction in knowing the truth about the person I was cast as 2 decades ago, who he was in real life, as a real human being who did heroic things and mattered to the people in his life. And of course, the one lesson I should have already known before I got into any of this: you never get the right Private Zelensky on your first try.
John Stanley Zelensky was born on January 1st, 1925, in Chicago, Illinois, one of 5 children. He enlisted in the military on April 29th, 1943. The first time he ever rode in an airplane was also the first time he was instructed to jump out of said airplane. He was wounded in Holland on September 30th, 1944, and continued his service in Europe until the end of the war, and was honorably discharged on December 18th, 1945. He married his wife Bernice on September 27th, 1957. The friendship John fostered with Major Dick Winters lasted long after the war ended. He died on March 14th, 1980, at the age of 55. According to those that knew him, he had lively, bright eyes.
Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite, with additional research assistance from Jacob Tender and consulting from Barry Finkel. Special thanks to my guests, Eric Jenderson, Mark Sauer, Mike and Ed Kokulski, and Adam Sims. Also thanks to Amy Mann for letting us use this song that's playing in the background. It's called Dear John, and can be found on her 2005 album, The Forgotten Arm. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, the email is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you are friends with Tom Hanks, whose first World War II movie was not 1998's Saving Private Ryan, but 1986's Every Time We Say Goodbye. It's a romance, a serious drama about an American pilot enlisted in the British Royal Air Force, who is recovering from an injury in Jerusalem against the backdrop of the Second World War. And I have to admit, I have never seen it. But I used to stare at the cover of the VHS box at my local Movies To Go video rental store when I was a kid. At that point, I only knew Tom Hanks from comedies like Dragnet and Splash and The Money Pit. For a variety of reasons, I was never in the right mood to rent Every Time We Say Goodbye. Maybe I will be soon. But for now, I will say goodbye to you until next season. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Get vaccinated as soon as you can. Wear a mask.
Was a HeadGum original.